Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Batman Nightcast, a proud part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
And this month we're taking a break from our coverage of Mark Waid and Chris Samnee's Batman and Robin Year One to cover a classic Silver Age Batman tale. But we're not alone. We're joined by our brothers from another Martha, straight out of the Overlook Dark Knight podcast. Please welcome Michael Bailey and Andrew Leyland back to Nightcast. Hey, guys.
Why did you say that?
Hey, guys.
Yes.
Yeah, you had to ruin it and say that name. Come on. Thank you for having us.
Yes.
Always a pleasure. Never a chore.
We appreciate you saying that. You say that now.
Right.
I'm just delighted. The Fire & Water Network is finally letting me do my Erwolf show.
Are you going to skip the fourth season?
Always. Always skip the fourth season.
Okay, that's fair.
Was it the Van Dyke guys, the Van Dyke sons? Isn't he the lead on that? The Dick
yes.
Van Dyke's kids? Yeah.
Okay. Barry Van Dyke had a career for a short time of replacing other better, more charismatic actors because he was also in Galactica 1980 replacing Dirk Benedict.
That's right. That's right. Him and the dude from Adam 12. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, the dude from Farscape, if you're younger than Methuselah here, but.
But since this is a Batman podcast and unfortunately not an Airwolf podcast, I just want to hear Andy say Stringfellow Hawk over and over because that's just such a great name. But this story we're going to talk about today centers around Clayface. So he is a character who, believe it or not, is going to have his own feature film in about a month released. So what are your guys' thoughts on the Clayface film? Are you looking forward to it? Are you puzzled why DC would do this? What are your thoughts, Michael?
First of all, we invited you guys at the time that I had this idea. I thought Clayface was going to be a much bigger deal and that the advertisement for this movie, and they were going to be pushing a much bigger thing. And I don't know if there's been a second trailer for the movie.
To answer Chris's question, I'm old and there's wolves after me, so everything baffles me at this point. I look at what DC Studios is doing to launch their current iteration of trying desperately to get these characters to the big screen and have any kind of success comparative to Marvel. And to a certain extent, it seemed like they were following the model DC was about 5 years ago. The comics were where they like had different things for different audiences. Like you had the Batman Superman book for more of an old school thing. You had like the contemporary stuff if you were into the regular universe. And it seemed like they were trying to please everybody. I think opening a Clayface film before a Batman film is confusing. Not that I'm going to say people are going to be sitting in the theater going, "Where's Batman?" Because I think what they're really going to be doing is, "Who's Clayface?" in all honesty, because he's, despite being on the animated series, this isn't a character that has broken big outside of the comics. So I'm just more confused. I mean, I'm not saying that I don't like it because it's a Clayface movie. One of my problems is that it's a body horror movie, and I'm not into that. So it's a weird mixing of feelings.
I was baffled when I heard that they were announcing this.
What does baffle mean?
completely confused and befuddled. And like Mike just said, I think even before the 90s cartoon, Clayface wasn't an A-lister, was he?
I don't think I had heard of the character before the 90s cartoon.
Like, yeah, I think that cartoon elevated an awful lot of characters, including Mr. Freeze.
Right.
But particularly Clayface, because Feet of Clay, that is genuinely one of the best two-parters of the run.
Mm-hmm.
But we never really, I don't think we'd had a great Clayface story at that point. Maybe Mortal Clay, possibly. But the fact that they had to keep reinventing him in the comics, what were we up to by that point? Chris would know more than I would.
There's
Clayface 4.
Yeah, it was 4.
So we were up to Clayface 4 by the time they did the Mud Pack. So the fact that this guy was getting a film, if it had been Marvel, I probably wouldn't have been surprised because they were really churning the C&D listers by Phase 4. But the DC's essentially only had, what, two big screen film releases within this new continuity at the minute?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Clayface is going to be the third one. I'm like, okay, well, fair play to James Gunn. If you think you can pull this off, okay, fine.
If this was in the world of the Matt Reeves Batman, which I thought it was when they were first going ahead with it, I assumed it was. Okay, I can kind of see that. And I liked the Batman a lot more than I thought I would. I liked the Penguin a lot more than I thought I would. So I'm kind of wanting to give them some grace. Like, do I think this makes sense? No, I don't. But as we've seen this summer, Masters of the Universe was pretty much a flop. Supergirl was a flop. The Star Wars movie was a flop comparatively. Spider-Man apparently made up for all three of those in spades. So, I mean, it would not surprise me if Clayface is financially more successful than all the other three.
I think you've got to take into account as well, though, that Masters of the Universe, Supergirl, The Mandalorian, they were all just resolutely three-star movies. There was nothing wrong with any of them. Mm-hmm. All three of them were perfectly entertaining for the 2 hours that you were watching them. But you weren't rushing out to your friends to say, you've got to go see this. Anyone asked me about those three, I just went, yeah, it was fine. Whereas I think if Clayface can hit with the people who went watching, was it Possession or Obsession?
Obsession.
Obsession, yeah.
And I don't know what the budget of Clayface is, but James Gunn has gone to great lengths to say, no, this is a very low-budget production in comparison to our other films. I can see it being more profitable, certainly, than some of the others, if they're not spending a great chunk of change on it.
The thing that I am more hopeful about this one, which is something that I didn't know about until just a few days ago, is that the story and the script for the movie are credited to Mike Flanagan, who right now is like my favorite writer in like horror, like starting with his Netflix series, The House on Haunted Hill, Haunting of Hill House is maybe a top five all-time TV series for me. I just love that series. But he's also been like, he's done a great job adapting Stephen King, which is not always easy. He did Dr. Sleep, which was the sequel to The Shining, which...
Oh, that was good.
Yeah, that was very good.
That was really good. It could be fun. And I mean, his horror isn't relying on a lot of jump scares or body horror that much. It's a lot more atmospheric mood and tension building. And his scripts are also usually very thoughtful, and there's a lot more meaning and nuance to his stories. So... that makes me hopeful that there's a little bit more meat to this one. I don't know anything about the director, so they could push this in a very different way. But I think at the very least, it'll be an interesting character, maybe a sympathetic kind of character study. And based on if he's going out to get revenge, like this might actually be more like Darkman in terms of a comic book type of feel. Like, I don't know, we'll see.
If he doesn't break somebody's fingers and then they like, you know, close in on him screaming and the guy screaming and his girlfriend screaming, then I'm out. That's what when I think of Darkman, that's the scene I think of. That's Sam Raimi. Yeah.
Which Clayface is it?
I think it's sort of like the animated series version where it's Matt Hagen in name, right? Because it sounds like a more everyday name than Basil. Like Carlo. But he is an actor. So they've kind of taken that whole idea of he's an actor whose face is damaged. And then he has to take this, you know, special serum to fix this thing.
I feel like I'm kind of with Ryan. It could be that this is the most profitable DC film just because of the lean in on the indie horror, even though it's not indie, it's Warner Brothers, obviously, but it might draw that crowd in, and I'm looking forward to it. I do think it's odd. I do think it's odd, but at this point, you know, I'm letting them, you know, experiment, do what they, you know, I'm willing to give them a chance because I've enjoyed everything they've done. The Guns DC has done to a point. I'm really liking Lantern so far. You know, I'm on board. I'm giving them a shot, but yeah, it is an odd direction. It is, like you said, Andrew, the fact that Marvel started digging into the well deeper was different because they got through some of the big guns first, and then they kind of earned the, like, okay, we'll make a Shang-Chi movie, and it actually is really good, you know, and so, but it's like, yeah, Clayface is, you know, with just Superman and Supergirl and odd Peacemaker series in Creature Commandos, which of course they did do Creature Commandos right out of the gate, even before Superman. So that, I guess that was really the first DCU project. So I guess they kind of set that precedent early, even though it was an animated thing. So I don't know. We'll wait. We'll have to see. And, you know, by the time this, well, now it comes out, sometime in October. So we've still got it like another month or so before it comes out. But has anyone seen season 2 of Batman Caped Crusader?
I'm up to episode 7.
Okay, we don't want to spoil it then. Ryan, have you seen
the last three episodes suck?
Yeah.
that would be typical though, wouldn't it? I think, what do you think? Do you think this season's got a little bit OTT with the violence?
Yeah.
We've had two people shot in the head on camera.
Yeah, I do feel like sometimes it's a little like we're being edgy to be edgy, kind of, you know, with the language and I can see that. It's kind of like my same, like I liked Lanterns, but the first episode, there were so many F-bombs that I'm like, wow. I mean, I'm not a prude, but it's like, I think they were just doing it to just say, yeah, this is edgy, you know, let's cuss some more, you know, that kind of thing. You know?
Yeah, but with the thing with Lanterns, I've only seen the first episode of Lanterns. The thing I think from Lanterns is they're making an HBO show first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you kind of expect that from an HBO show.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the end of the day, this is a Batman cartoon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I certainly think that one of the, I think it's episode 2 or 3, the Riddler actually puts his gun in the window of a vehicle and shoots a guy in the head. And you see him shoot the guy in the head.
Mm-hmm.
And even, and I love like Spartacus. I'm totally down with Spartacus. But I thought, well, did we need, should we not have just seen him put the gun in the window? Mm-hmm. We didn't need to see him shoot him in the head. On a cartoon that ostensibly is still going to have kids' eyeballs on it. As good as it is at being a crime noir 1940s thing, and it is very, very good, I do sometimes think, are you not doing it a bit wrong if you're making a Superman or Batman project that kids can't watch?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what it is. Maybe if it's like an age thing, but I don't absorb as much of these cartoons the way I did. And I'm certain that it has something to do because they're just, it's not as formative of an experience for me. But like the Batman, the animated series episodes that I saw when I was a teenager, I can like transcribe some of those episodes. But like these, like a month after I watched them, I'm like, did Bruce Wayne go to jail disguised as Matches Malone, or was that a dream I had? Like, I don't
yeah, I rewatched the first season before the second season came on because exactly the same, Ryan. I remember jack all about season one.
And I think dumping them all at once doesn't help. When they do it week by week, you kind of like, oh, you kind of got time to kind of savor it and think about it and like anticipate what they're going to do next. And it, but if you, you know, binge them, even if you just binge 2 or 3 together, then it just kind of, it just all kind of lumps in your brain and it just kind of like, I don't know, filters out. It just, it doesn't stick. It like, it's literally like, it's just like a fire hose. You know, it like fire hose in your brain and nothing sticks. I'm using
the. I love that analogies. Batman's very much the creature of the night, like a secondary character in it. The show is very much focused on Bruce and Alfred, Commissioner Gordon, Barbara Gordon, Rennie Montoya. All of Bullock's not been in the second season as much as the first season because he got demoted, didn't he? But it's very much a character piece. I love the aesthetic of it. I think that whole 1940s milieu, this should have been in black and white. Forget Spider-Noir. I think there should have been a black and white version of this one. But it makes Batman much more effective when he shows up because he doesn't show up every episode at the same time to do the same things. Sometimes you'll be halfway through an episode and I'm noticing I've not even missed that he's there. That's how good it is. I genuinely do love the show. I think it's brilliant. I think maybe they've gone OTT on the violence, but that may just be me.
And part of that is the tonal thing, but I do think you're right. Like when it feels at its best, it reminds me, it's like Boardwalk Empire with Batman in it. But there are other times where like I'm like, okay, I appreciate having your own unique stamp on a character, especially the villains. We're going to do something really different with the Riddler. It's like, okay, but you've made him so different. Like, why is he even called the Riddler? Like, he doesn't come up with riddles or puzzles or anything. Like, that's not even his, like, he has no gimmick in this. So why is that his name? And I think that's why they just call him Eddie the whole time.
He's riddling people with machine guns. I mean, that's
a little bit closer to it.
That's really why they call him the Riddler. And like I mentioned, my understanding is they based him on Richard Widmark, who Frank Gorshin did impersonations of, and Richard Widmark was known for this kind of unhinged tough guy gangster. He played a lot of, you know, in noir movies. And so they're literally like going backwards through the inspiration of the characters for both him and the Joker. Cause you got Conrad Veidt as the Joker basically. You know, from The Man Who Laughs. And so, I mean, it's interesting, but it's kind of like, some of the things they do, it's like they definitely are doing it just to like, this isn't your dad's Batman the Animated Series, and with the violence and the language, I think they're doing that too. But it's like there's elements about it enough that it's like, well, it feels kind of like Batman the Animated Series, and at this season, What's the Hamish Linklater? That's the
yeah, wizard. Doing the voice. Yeah.
There was a couple times he sounded even more like Kevin Conroy this season.
Yeah.
There was a couple of, you know, like, especially when he was like getting hurt, he'd make that, you know, distinctive Kevin Conroy sound. And I was like, what, did they loop Conroy in? It's like, I'm like hearing Conroy, but not that he needs to do that. He's good. He doesn't need to do that, but he sounds enough like him. And you're looking at Bruce Timm's Batman and you're like, okay, This is surreal sometimes, but I really enjoyed it. I thought this season was better than the first. Although, like you guys, I don't remember what really happened in the first. I just remember liking it, you know. So
I did find it interesting that they cast Peter Parker in the episode I just watched, and now I'm struggling to remember who the bad guy was.
Oh,
the one before episode 7,
the one with the monk.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was Peter Parker, man. That was John Romita's Peter Parker they were doing as the model.
I thought the same thing. I'm like, why does he look like Peter Parker?
But yeah, overall, I've been really impressed with it. I've really enjoyed it. I think it's just different enough from Batman the Animated Series. And like you said, this Hamish Linklater guy, he is the first time they've done an animated Batman program I've not missed Kevin Conroy.
Sadly, I just because of the vagaries of life, I've not gotten to watch it yet. I love the fact, though, because I love Hamish Linklater. Everything I've ever seen him in, I've loved. He was really good in The Big Short. He was great on The Newsroom. He was in
Midnight Mass.
Yeah, I was about to say again.
He was the priest in Midnight Mass. Yeah.
But to ask, just throw a question out there. So that I could have some part of this conversation outside of, oh, you guys watched it and I didn't.
Listeners, you don't realize, I thought Michael was asleep for the last 5 minutes.
Yeah.
No, that's what he does, our show.
But to go on to the thing of you don't remember something like a minute after you've watched it, do you think that has a lot to do with the fact that we have so much of this material now that nothing ever has a chance to land? Because, like, Batman the Animated Series, we remember because when it was first on, it was shown every afternoon. So you watched it, and then you watched the same episodes again and again and again and again. So it had time to, like, seep into your consciousness. But now they're like, okay, you've got Spider-Man Noir, and you've got the first season of this, and you got the second season of this, and you're moving on to Creature Commandos, and you're moving on to Lanterns. You never go back, except if you're Andy, to refresh yourself. And that's the only reason you went back, was you wanted to remember, because you're watching the second season. If the second season never had happened, you wouldn't have gone back and watched it recently. So do you think we just have so much of this material now that there's no, like just to keep up with everything, you can't let anything, like, stew in your own brain?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that's because there's one episode of Batman the Animated Series when it first aired I missed, called The Worry Men, that has the Mad Hatter. And I missed that one when it aired. My VCR VHS tape didn't work that day or whatever. I had my VCR set up to record it. And I still don't, because I didn't watch that one over and over like I did the others. It's kind of, even though I have it on DVD and Blu-ray, it's still kind of the lost Batman episode. I don't remember that one as well because I haven't rewatched it in reruns or like on my videotape like I did. So yeah, you're right. I think that's part of it. We've got so much coming at us. It's an embarrassment of riches with the geek media that we get. It just kind of comes at us and then it just drifts away kind of thing. So yeah.
And it's also, like you, I didn't get it every day. I got Batman the Animated Series every Saturday morning. But I would watch that episode 2 or 3 times in the week. And we don't have that kind of time anymore, or I don't. It's increasingly difficult to find time to even watch something that's only an hour with everything else that you've got going on. Whereas somebody was on the radio the other day talking about renting videos from the VHS store. And Angela was sat in the car going, did you do that? And I said, yeah, I distinctly remember I rented Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan of an afternoon over a summer holiday or something. I watched it that afternoon. I watched it that night with my grandparents. And then I watched it again the next morning before I took it back. So I watched that film 3 times in a 24-hour period. I cannot imagine doing that with anything at the moment, just from a time management point of view.
I mean, also, when I was watching the animated series, I sat down and I watched it. And it was my focus. And now I will cop to it. Like when I'm watching The Caped Crusader, I've also got a phone in my hand. and I'm doom scrolling whatever social media, or I'm playing a game and my attention is divided. That certainly plays a factor in why not every part of it resonates, or why not every part of it sticks with me. Anyway, before we get to our featured story, we want to give a big shout out to our Patreon sponsor for this episode, J. David Weeder. If you want to be awesome like Dave, consider supporting Batman Nightcast or any other show on the Fire and Water Podcast Network at patreon.com/FWPodcast.
Batman number 159 was cover dated November 1963. On the cover by Sheldon Moldoff, Batman, Robin, and Bat-Girl confront a strange figure who seems to be the Joker, who, as Ryan put it, dug his way out of jail Andy Dufresne style. But no, it's Clayface, who had disguised himself as the Joker, which the astute Masked Manhunter points out. What do we think?
I'm sorry, I thought you said Hyman. Being a small child, I couldn't stop laughing.
I think, isn't he like Highfather? Isn't that, or is that another of the new gods?
That's another one, yeah. That's okay. The inventor guy.
But all I can think is Robin wants to remove the Hyman.
Oh my God. This is the not safe for work edition of Batman
sorry, guys.
To answer your question, one, this does make me think of that Robot Chicken skit where the Joker was Andy Dufresne and all that. And I'm just going to say this, my overarching note of the story as well. Anybody who wants to sit there and try to convince me that the Batman 66 series was not in any way like the comics of the 60s, I'm going to just show them this issue. I could totally see this happening to Adam West and Burt Ward.
Yeah, if they could afford it to do Clayface, absolutely.
Yeah, so
sure.
But no, it's a good cover. I wish Batgirl had more to do in the actual story, but it's nice that she's on the cover.
Yeah, if you have a look on Mike's Amazing World and look at all the covers, it is a cover of the time period. There's nothing wrong with it. I don't mind it at all. I do like her costume. I like Batgirl's costume. I think that's quite a cute costume.
Yeah, I like the fact that it's basically like more of a Robin, like a female Robin costume versus a female Batman costume. Yeah, yeah. The Great Clayface Joker Feud. Script Bill Finger. Pencils. Some controversy on who drew this. Grand Comic Database and Mike's Amazing World say Sheldon Moldoff with Charles Perris on inks. The Greatest Joker Stories Ever Told credits some combo of Jim Mooney and Sheldon Moldoff. So take your pick, but.
I've got the Joker 80 Years of the Clown Prince of Crime. What does mine say? Mine says Sheldon Moldoff and Charles Paris.
Okay. There you go.
Kathy Kane and her niece Betty are walking along suburban Gotham when Batman and Robin pull up in the Batmobile like, hey, girl, hey. The ladies can't wait to see their male counterparts out of their costumes, but a flash bulletin on the radio interrupts their thirsting. Matt Hagen, better known as the shape-changing villain Clayface, has escaped from prison. While looking for Hagen, Batman and Robin follow a completely unrelated giant eagle into the Gotham Expo Center. Inside, they're shocked to discover that the eagle, go birds, that's just for Brett Young, is Clayface. I, too, was also shocked to learn that Clayface's metamorphic powers granted him access to other superhuman abilities, like flight. Chasing Clayface through a scale model of the city on the convention floor, Batman tries to stop the criminal by throwing a building at him. Clayface cleverly does that thing that Clay is so well known for, changing into an electric-powered desk fan and shattering the model building on its spiked blades. How could the world's greatest detective not seen that coming? Clayface then changes into a giant woolly mammoth and starts to trash the place with proportionately mammoth strength. When his powers start to fade because of a newly contrived 5-hour time limit. In desperation, Clayface changes into a fiery meteor and flies away, setting the exposition hall ablaze. Classic Clay, am I right? Some expository panels tell us that after the last time Batman captured Matt Hagen, he blew up the cave containing the pool of mysterious liquid that gives Hagen his powers. Hagen had hidden a small batch of the liquid, however, and has managed to fashion a synthetic blend. The only drawback is the power expires after 5 hours. Regardless, the Gotham underworld is so impressed by Clayface's work that they are ready to declare him the nation's number one ne'er-do-well. But the Joker's all like, the hell you say? The next night, Batman and Robin go to an airbase where NASA, or some military branch, is honoring Batwoman by naming their latest space rocket after her. The base commander puts a crown on Batwoman's head and dubs her Queen of Space. but the Joker appears out of nowhere, having snuck up on them in the costume of a court jester, which he used presumably to blend in with the crowd of military officers and scientists. The Joker grabs Batwoman's crown and runs off. His biggest offense, though, was not making a joke about how many pilots will get inside the Batwoman, or can the Batwoman really handle three spacemen at the same time?
Bat-hyphen, not hymen, girl, chases the Joker as Batman and Robin arrive. As Batman closes in, the Joker reveals himself to be Clayface in disguise. Panicking, Clayface changes into a winged sphinx and flies away, because if you can change into a flying animal or object, why not a sphinx? A distraught Batgirl sets the feminist movement back several years by asking Robin to hold her in his pubescent yet strong, manly arms. Batwoman tries the same tactic on Batman, who maintains a stoic facade by thinking about baseball or dead parents, probably. Elsewhere, the Joker reacts to being called out by Clayface. They're full-on beefing now. What's the super criminal equivalent of a diss track? The dynamic duo finds out when an anonymous tip informs them that Clayface is robbing the Gotham Museum. They find Clayface disguised as an African sculpture, but he unmasks to reveal it's really the Joker, unless it's Clayface pretending to be the Joker again. Before they can catch him, the maybe Joker strips off the African costume to reveal another costume beneath, a bodysuit covered in deadly quills that he shoots at Batman and Robin. Joker then sheds that inner outer layer to reveal a third costume underneath, a winged butterfly suit complete with a jetpack, which he uses to fly away, claiming that he can commit shape-changing crimes every bit as absurdly as Clayface. Batman appears on the news announcing that he will bodyguard a visiting diplomat and priceless gem while Robin searches for the master criminal Clayface. Clayface knows that insult, which sounds a lot like bait for a trap if you think about it for more than 2 seconds, will provoke the Joker into trying to steal the gem from Batman, which is exactly what the Joker tries to do. But Clayface gets the jump on both the Caped Crusader and the Clown Prince of Crime by brilliantly disguising himself as a no parking sign on the street. He then changes into a gorilla, using his superior strength to carry Batman, Joker, and the gem to his hideout. Clayface demands that the Joker admit he's the superior criminal, and the Joker readily obliges, which seems suspicious if you think about it for more than 2 seconds. Joker then suggests they settle their beef and work together after Clayface unmasks Batman. Clayface does so and is shocked to discover that beneath the Bat Cowl is a Batman robot whose face is covered with clay for a reason so obvious, I don't even feel like explaining it. The Joker delivers the kind of singular knockout punch that will someday make Batman famous for taking out an obnoxious Green Lantern. Then unmasked to reveal the Joker is actually the Dark Knight Detective. Once Matt Hagen's power wears off and he's back in jail, Batman explains the ruse, including the part where the Joker was already captured by Batwoman and Batgirl. In the aftermath of the great Joker-Clayface feud, the Bat-ladies offer to help the Bat-fellas disprove Dr. Wortham's scandalous claims about their sexuality.
You know, when you say it like that, it sounds ridiculous.
I've heard Batwoman and Batgirl were introduced in order to suggest that, you know, Batman and Robin do not have this homosexual relationship. This didn't convince me.
It seemed like the women were
throwing themselves, and they were like, the guys were like, ah.
I think Robin's more responsive than Batman is. Robin certainly seems down with it.
But, you know, Robin, Dick always was way more into the ladies than Bruce ever was. I mean, come on, you know, Starfire, you know, come on, you know. So, you know, it's like.
On the one hand, this is dumber than dirt. On the other hand, it is marvelously entertaining. You know, I think I just had the goofiest grin while I was reading this, because it is literally, and then this happened, and then this happened. And then this happened. It is literally plotted like a 12-year-old tells a story, which is its great strength, because this is literally being written for 12-year-old boys. I loved it. This was a really good pick. My only confusion, I say only confusion, there are so many things to be confused about in this story. But my main confusion was, since when did Clayface becoming the thing that he's turning into meant that he could do those things?
Yeah, that's, I mean, why couldn't he just be Superman all the time? You know, just turn into Superman.
Yeah, I mean, it starts on the cover, not on the first page, sorry, on the splash page. So turning into a gorilla gives him the strength of a gorilla. Has that always been the case?
I'd have to go back and read his first appearance in this era to know.
See, now I did.
completely by accident. Okay. I have the 80 years books, and I picked the wrong one off my bookshelf and took it to work with me to read in my lunch hour. So I ended up rereading the first appearance of Clayface purely by accident. And he can't do this in the first appearance.
Okay, my no prize is that it's the synthetic version of the formula that gives him these powers.
And I bet you he put tar in it because he couldn't figure out one of the components.
My favorite panel, beyond a shadow of a doubt, is the one where Batman and Robin stand in front of the exposition hall delivering mouthfuls of exposition. Brilliant. Just perfect.
It's interesting. To quote Phineas and Ferb, if I had a nickel for every Batman story I read over the last week where Clayface disguises himself as the Joker, I'd have two nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice between this and the Batman Resurrection novel where Clayface disguises himself as the Joker. I said it before, I'm going to say it again. Michael Uslan, who seems like a lovely gentleman, and we owe a great debt to him for all the Batman films that we've gotten over the years. But I watched, thanks to Andy recommending it, that Icons Reveal, whatever, it's a series on Amazon that covers various geek things. And one of them was about the Batman movies. And they're interviewing Michael Uslan, and he's talking about, he was 14 years old, he's watching the first episode of the Batman TV series from 1966, and he's crestfallen because it's not like his comics. And then I read comics from that era, and I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm not saying like Batman 66 was always the pinnacle of Batman storytelling. The first season is definitely the best. The second season falls off a cliff about halfway through. This would be, to me, a third season episode, which they would never do because they didn't have the budget for it. But still, just in terms of the quality of it, it's a weird Batwoman and Batgirl story, because my main exposure to Robin and this version of Batgirl is him like doing everything to get away from her. And in this one, he seems for it. I was a little upset because I know in the scene where Batwoman is kind of the first time Batwoman is kind of coming on to Batman, he's like shaking. And I guess it's supposed to be played as comedic, like, oh, girl talking to me. It actually looks like he's about to punch her in the face. like he looks like he's about to get violent, which isn't funny, but it's kind of absurd. This is a perfectly, like most Silver Age stories, it's fun. It doesn't make a lick of sense most of the time. This story, doubly so. Batgirl and Batwoman are barely in it. I'm really uncomfortable with the fact that they're naming a rocket after Batwoman and they painted it pink. It's not the most sexist thing that happens in this issue, but it's one, or this story, but it's one of them. But at the same time, it's fun. These types of stories happen all the time. The Joker from this era was more concerned about his reputation than murdering people. And I kind of like that to a certain extent. Like he can't stand that Clayface has been named the most popular criminal, so he has to do something about it. And my final note, and this is a practical one, how hot was it to sit there in three layers of costumes before getting to the butterfly with the jetpack? I mean, the quills alone were probably, he's probably like sweating profusely. And he's just like, thank God I get to take these things off. I know you're not supposed to think about that in terms of the story, but as an adult and you read these things, you're like, God, that. It's like whenever I see a story where it's like Batman breaks a rib, but then he goes on to fight like 15 guys, I pull my side. I want to sit down for a week. So it's just something you're not supposed to think of. Andy said it. This is a story for a 12-year-old from 1963. And on that level, I think it works.
A little bit behind the curtain. We wanted to do this team up with you guys. And I was like, let's do something Clayface related because of the movie and because Chris and I have only talked about Clayface on 10 episodes from the last year. So, yes. You know, we really need an excuse to do another one. And then when I was just kind of looking up Silver Age Clayface, because I, other than reading his Secret Origin in Secret Origins, I don't know if I'd really read a Silver Age Clayface story. So I was like, wait, this is a team up, a Clayface and Joker team up. We want to do a team up podcast. Perfect. Thematically, it's great. So I send you guys, we'll do this one. And then I read the story. And like Andy, I got to the end of it and I was like, well, this is dumb as shit. But I mean, I feel that way about a great many Silver Age comics, but it doesn't set the enjoyment. It's like, you got to kind of get to it. The thing about like giving Clayface these powers that he's never had before, like that part reminded me of like a Bob Haney comic. Like I was surprised he wasn't created on this. Like he's just going to fundamentally change something about a character to fit the whim of this particular story. And I'm like, all right, whatever. Let's just go with it.
Yeah, this is written by Batman's co-creator, Bill Finger. But no, I enjoy this. I can set my brain to enjoy different eras of comics. So like I can read this one and just try to kind of put myself in that. Well, my mindset isn't too far from a 12-year-old, honestly. But, you know, I feel like the Batman books at this point were just straight up copying the Mort Weisinger Superman output. And he was most definitely aiming it at younger kids. Maybe like 8 to 12, they would read like the Superman and Batman books and then graduate to Julius Schwartz's, you know, slightly more sophisticated Flash, Green Lantern, Justice League that had a little more like actual science mixed in with the science fiction flashbacks and things like that. But, you know, and then in the artwork, you know, Sheldon Moldoff was actually a really great illustrator. He was his Hawkman in the Golden Age was very much like an Alex Raymond level of detail that he put in. So he could draw like circles around the Bob Kane style that he's doing here. But at this point, he's gotten in such a, he's got it down so pat that it's like, it's almost like it's very primitive compared to most of the other comics of the time, like, you know, even, you know, what Carmine Infantino and Gil Kane and are doing in the other DC titles. But there's something about it that is still appealing, even though he always draws everybody's hands so tiny. Like Sheldon Moldoff's hands are so tiny on his figures. It's always weird. But, you know, I like it. I like that. I'm more of a Dick Sprang guy. I just love Dick Sprang's work, and he was still working, like I think this is around the time he retired. But you know, I enjoy this, and I agree, Michael, it's in what you guys said earlier, this is very much that type of feeling of Batman 66. And I really don't get, I know I have read the fanzines from that era where the fans are just foaming at the mouth, much like fans nowadays when a version of their hero is interpreted into a media and not, you know, translated exactly the way they want to see it. But clearly they had built up what it actually was versus what's in print, because this is more in that vein of Batman 66. There's a couple little fun things. I do think it's funny how on the page where Clayface is changing from the Woolly Mammoth back into Clayface, he briefly looks like Man-Thing, panel 2 on page 4.
Yeah,
it's like he's the prototype Man-Thing. There's little things like that. And, you know, it's nice to see Batman Woman and Batgirl, even though they don't get to do much. And it's in the bit where Batgirl really is, you know, like, oh, Robin, hold me. But I do like the fact that Batwoman is kind of like making fun of the fact that she's doing that, but also using it to try to like, you know, poke Batman and say, hey, Batman, how about you hold me? You know, that's kind of a fun. That's a little more kind of an adult kind of thing there. And you can see Adam West, like if there was a Batwoman just kind of, you know, like starting to sweat underneath his cowl as you know, somebody said that to him. So, yeah, it's fun. I enjoy it. Like I said, I can switch my brain into Silver Age mode and just accept these stories for what they are and enjoy them. So I had fun with it.
It's interesting you comparing it to the Silver Age Flash, which I'm dipping in and out of every now and again, because you can't read big chunks of the Silver Age stuff. You do have to take a break and go back to it every now and again. And I agree with you entirely. That does seem to skew slightly older than this. And that Flash stuff that Julius Schwartz was overseeing, so that is still pretty damn good. And over in Superman as well, the Superman of the Silver Age can lean into the silly, but with Superman, there always felt like there was heart to the stories as well. It always felt like they were going for something a little bit deeper if you wanted to scratch the surface of the death of Superman is dark. That's a really dark storyline that's from roughly around the same time period. I never get that vibe when I read a Silver Age Batman story.
it really does read like they were writing it purely on a superficial level for 12-year-old boys. And I don't disagree with you. I loved this. I genuinely had a good time with it. But it does seem to me like there are other DC books of the time that had slightly more going on than this did.
Yeah. I think with Superman, Weisinger was like building the mythos. You know, he was adding like every so many months a new element. And he was like expanding the world, the lore of Krypton and the legacy of Superman. And you didn't really get that as much with Batman. They did some things that did that, but it didn't, I don't know. They were too busy trying to copy what they were doing in the Superman offices, by introducing, Batwoman, Batgirl, Bat-Hound, he's got Crypto. And I mean, I'm surprised we didn't get I guess we did get a Bat Ape at some point, but we didn't get a Bat Monkey and Bat Horse and, all that. But, I think you're right. I think the Superman books might've skewed younger as well, but I think they were still a little less juvenile than this. And then in the Wonder Woman books, Robert Kanigher's doing just like insane stuff over there with having like Wonder Woman from different periods interacting. And that's how you get Wonder Girl and the Teen Titans, because he had literally had Diana as a teenager running around with Diana as an adult. And Bob Haney just like, oh, that's a separate character. I'll just use her in this Teen Titans story, So yeah, meanwhile, now you understand why Marvel started mowing their grass when they started appealing to the teens and then the college age kids, So yeah.
One of the things about this story that did strike me in reading it and reading the second story in the issue, it's kind of like reading Superman stories circa 1984, 1985, where you're looking at it, it's like, oh, this is why they changed everything. Because we're only a year away from the new look era in this. That wasn't as drastic of a change, obviously, as John Byrne's Man of Steel, but it was kind of a step away from the sillier aspects. They're all still very gimmick-based. You read those Carmine Infantino-drawn issues of Batman, and it's really just like, the mystery, the setup, can you figure it out? And at the end, everything is revealed. So on that level, it's not too dissimilar from this. It's just, it has more of a veneer of its own identity at that point. And I'm like reading this, and I could see like a kid who may be getting a little sick of this type of thing from the 60s going, man, I don't want to read Batman anymore. Which is a weird thing to say, because we're still, even though Superman has managed to garner some popularity over the last couple of years, thanks to the movie from 2025, Batman is still the most popular DC character by far. And it's interesting looking at this era, because this is from an era where he wasn't popular. So it's not that I'm saying one is better than the other. I'm not saying, wow, Julia Schwartz came out of the Batman books and suddenly they were readable again. But I will say I'm kind of looking at this going, yeah, I kind of see why DC took a step back and said maybe we need to make some changes here.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that, supposedly, at one point, like Detective was going to get canceled. They brought Schwartz in. And I think they definitely did, like they aged Robin up a little bit, and they added the oval to the, or circle really, to the costume, streamlined the Batmobile, all that stuff. But they definitely did, like you said, they were more like mystery stories. They didn't bring the villains back for like a year. The first year, the classic rogues didn't come back. They jettisoned most of the sci-fi stuff. They had a few stories here and there. So they did kind of, okay, it wasn't as back to basics as Batman in 1970 became, but it was still, on that road to like getting back to this, creature of the night, Batman. It was like, that was the step in between this and the Neil Adams, Denny O'Neill Batman, in a lot of ways. But yeah, a kid would probably, like if you read The Flash and then you read this and you're like, wow, this art style looks like it's from another like era. It's like, this does not look like the other DC comics. And Bob Kane was under contract to produce so many comics, and he, of course, farmed everything out at this point to Moldoff. DC had that contract with him, and it wasn't until Infantino became the art director and then the publisher that he basically bought Bob Kane's contract out, and that was finally the end of that. It's funny how this, you see this progression happen. And like we said, Marvel is starting to, really get a lot of readers going, looking over their way and attracting an older audience and an audience that wanted to stick with comics, but probably couldn't stand to keep reading stuff aimed at 12-year-olds or 8-year-olds, it's an interesting time in comics, and Batman was, he's 2 years away from his most popular era ever too, with the advent of the TV show. Well, 3 years in this issue, 3 years away from 1966, obviously. So
20 years ago, when I really wanted to do a deep dive into more of DC's history, I started getting a bunch of the showcase collections, the black and white, mm-hmm. like cheap newsprint versions, because they were so easily affordable. And I got a ton of those and just started. And of all of them, especially like the ones set in like the 50s, 60s, like Silver Age era, I was really surprised and impressed by how readable The Flash was, and how even like that one held up, and that one felt the most like Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and those early like 60s ones, in that when you read The Flash from the beginning, every issue was introducing a concept or a character or a villain that is still in use today. Like they were building, like every issue was like something is like, okay, this is this rogue. We still see that rogue every month in the current books. This is Kid Flash. This is Ralph Dibny. This is, some origin thing. And it's like, it felt like I was just building upon the lore of The Flash that I knew, because retroactively was already established. But that was a fun. So I definitely think The Flash of that era, like there's a reason why they made such a big deal about that character, was because he was kind of the driving force of this new style of storytelling at DC.
If there is any character in the Silver Age at DC that is almost A for A to Spider-Man, and Andy and I talk about this a lot, it's The Flash. Like, it's not, even though Spider-Man became kind of the flagship and Superman was the flagship of DC, if you look at how those two characters kind of evolved, they were pretty much fully baked from the moment they were created. Like, Green Lantern took a little while, and Hawkman and Adam and all that took kind of a little while. And you look over at Marvel, the myth of Marvel is that Marvel was perfect from its creation, and that's just a damn lie in every way, shape, or form. A lot of those characters, like, you read the first handful of Tales of Suspense Iron Man issues, and they bear almost no relation to anything from Iron Man like 4 years later. But Spider-Man, with a few hiccups along the way, was pretty much a fully formed concept, and The Flash was the same. And you're right. It's like you look at Spider-Man, like the first 12 issues, all of those villains have now been in movies. They are the ones that they keep going back to. Mm-hmm. And all of the rogues in The Flash comics were the ones that the Grant Gustin series went to again and again and again. So it's kind of fascinating to look back at that, like from an almost academic sense, of how similar those two characters are, even though you could argue that the Spider-Man focused more on Peter Parker's private life and showing how crappy it could be to be a superhero, whereas the Flash's private life wasn't as rich, but he had a girlfriend and he got married and he was allowed to evolve. Andy's right. You can't sit there and binge an entire like Chronicles thing, because there is kind of a repetition to the storytelling, but there's still a lot of fun. And just reading a couple every once in a while is I will do that myself, because it's an interesting way to kind of watch that character evolve.
It's interesting. The Flash, the first issue of The Flash just got a facsimile edition. So of course I bought it. And if you read that and compare it to what they did with the John Wesley Shipp pilot, it is very faithful mm-hmm. to that first comic book. The thing that they do in the pilot is exactly what you just said, Michael. They beef up the personal life stuff. But the actual beat for beat of the origin, apart from the stuff that they lift from Wally West about needing to constantly eat and shredding his clothes and all that stuff, that is all there in that issue. From 19, was it 56? Something like that.
Yeah. Yep, 1956.
That John Wesley Shipp pilot is incredibly faithful for its like first 45 minutes or so. And then it goes off and does the rather trite biker gang plot. But you don't care by that point, because they've set up who Barry is and Amanda Pears was there. So
yes.
I still love that show. And John Wesley Shipp is such a nice guy. That's one of my best con experiences meeting him. So
yeah, well, Michael and I have discussed this an awful lot. It's like, do we wish it had got a second season? Yes. Are we glad that it's just 22 perfectly formed episodes? Also, yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's like Superman and Lois. Would I have liked more seasons? Yes. Am I glad that it ended on such a high note? Also, yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Did it never got to suck? There's something to be said for that. There's something to be said about knowing when to get off stage. And I know The Flash didn't get off stage. It was cancelled. But I think it does benefit in hindsight that now you look back at it and go, this show was good.
Yeah, that's right. And we're talking about everything but this comic that we read.
Well, it's just like what is there to talk about that we haven't really? I mean, we could break it down panel by panel, but I think that would be.
I put all my thoughts in the synopsis. I think the tone of the synopsis is pretty much how I was feeling about this.
And Ryan wrote the whole synopsis, by the way. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's like we don't want to be negative about it because genuinely, I read this with a massive goofy grin on my face.
All right, I will ask then, what is your favorite Clayface transformation in this issue? Like, what's your favorite thing that he turns into? Because I got to say, like, becoming the Human Torch all of a sudden?
My favorite was him becoming the parking thing because they literally cheat. That is not Clayface in Panel 3, and suddenly it becomes Clayface in Panel 4. That is a cheat, guys. I'm sorry. I read that and went, no way.
Where does all his masks go, that whole scientific, like, where does it go? Where does it come from? You know,
why has he changed color?
He can change color in this version. Yeah.
So that was my favorite because of how dumb fuck stupid it was.
I like the man thing panel. I'm sticking with his giant sized man thing right there. I like that. Yeah. So
the proboscis.
I think becoming the Griffin Sphinx hybrid was. I almost said Hyman. I guess we're all stuck on that, aren't we?
I've ruined your show. I am so sorry.
It's not the first time you've done this, Andy.
We knew what we were asking for.
I think it's funny that you would not. Like 10 years later, this type of story wouldn't happen in a Batman comic. Like when they brought Clayface 3 in, it's more of a horror type story where, you know, he's experimented upon himself. Another thing Andy and I talk about all the time, DC got really good when they started doing Marvel type stories. Or let me rephrase that because that's kind of reductive. DC, as far as what I like to read in comics, I get more out of when they take DC characters but do Marvel style characterization and subplots and such. And that was, you know, Clayface 3 was created by Len Wein, so you have a writer that had cut his teeth really in Marvel doing those types of stories, creating a character that became what he was. Not because he was, you know, like trying to stumble into something. He was trying to cure his own deformity as he saw it. Whereas this is a Clayface that is, I just found something in a cave and now I can turn into a man thing looking parking sign or whatever just to piss Andy off.
He turns into a fan. He turns into a desk fan.
With what's spikes? The internal workings of that? How does that work?
What is he spinning? You know, what is he spinning?
Somehow to make that work? I wouldn't have a problem if Metamorpho did that, but Clayface, I'm like, no, it's different.
And like, Plastic Man going from like being a bench to being Plastic Man, you buy that because it's comedy at that point, right?
Right, right.
This isn't played for comedy.
Although I will say in the animated series, Clayface was able to, you know, make little, like separate parts of himself and turn into little kids that shoplifted in the store where Barbara Gordon was. And then later he sent the little girl, Annie, out. Mm-hmm. And she had her own consciousness, and Robin like became her friend, and then he reabsorbed her. So that, I mean, and that's a fan favorite episode because it's just such a gut punch. But it's, you know, so it's like I will say there's some precedent for Clayface doing some really wacky crap with his powers that you wouldn't think he could do if he's just a shapeshifter, but you know, so.
So what you're saying, Chris, is that you would buy everything in this issue if there was a Shirley Walker score going under it.
Right. And Ron Perlman doing the voice. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That works.
That's what we got to have Ron Perlman come in and do the voice. Yeah. Now, the Preston Payne, Clayface, who me and Ryan want to rename Professor Payne, by the way.
It was right there.
Right there. Yeah. We covered that, you know, a while back. And I mean, the horror in that, it's like literally Marshall Rogers draws like him melting a woman and you can see her skeleton in amongst the goo that's left of her body. You know, it's like, oh my God. I mean, I don't know how that got past the comics code 1977-8, whatever it was. I don't know how that happened, but it did. It was 78, I guess, because it was an implosion. And but
if you look at the first three playfaces of the Mud Pack, they do really work as horror characters if treated that way. I mean, if you look at Basil Carlo, the way he was in the Golden Age, I think that was the one episode of season one of the Caped Crusader that I distinctly remember was the Clayface one. I think it was episode two, because that was great. And he works as a slasher villain and like a slasher horror thing. He's just got a mask, got a knife, and he's going like targeting these people in the theater close to him or the movie. And then you've got Preston Payne, who is the science fiction body horror, kind of like futurist element. And then with this one, with Matt Hagen, if treated seriously, like this kind of shape changing could get into like the whole invasion of the body snatchers type of fear of identity and betrayal, that aspect of horror. So I think this character functions that way really, really well, regardless of which Clayface it is. It's nice type of, I think he's just a more naturally horrific villain that really works in Batman's milieu and can go to darker places because of that, regardless of which one it is.
Yeah. There is no more proof than what you're all saying than this volume, 80 Years of the Clown Prince of Crime. This is on page 52, November 1963. The literal next story in this volume on page 69 is September 1973. So as you just said, Chris, exactly 10 years, and it's the Joker's five-way revenge. There is nothing in Marvel's canon that I can think of where you could publish two characters 10 years apart like that and they would be so substantially different as this is in the turn of a page.
Yeah, like the two stories are like four decades apart, not one.
Yeah. It is literally night and day.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing, I was looking on social media, which again, always a mistake. And I was digging into like you know, conversations between people. Second mistake. I get it. Schoolboy error. But somebody was calling out James Gunn over the tonal difference between the 2025 Superman film and Lanterns. And Gunn made the point. It's just like, he didn't say it. He said it a lot nicer than I'm about to say it. It's like, have you ever read a DC book? Like, have you ever looked at their canon? Like, yeah, they're, you know, you can publish gritty Batman and Jimmy Olsen stories and they exist in the same universe. Are we getting to a point, I know this is getting a little off track, but are we at a point where lore and continuity is getting so important again that it's kind of losing the fun of the stories? Because it seems like recently there was that Supergirl Summer Special came out, and I know this was something Mark Waid did.
What you're going to say, yeah.
And watching the mental gymnastics of going to trying to fit every like the pre-crisis Supergirl that died in Crisis 7 and the post-crisis Supergirl that existed post the Superman Batman storyline and making them the same character. I'm like, why can't we just say it was just two different eras? Why can't we say that, and why can't we also say that within an era things can be radically different tonally? Why does everything have to fit in neat boxes? Didn't we learn the mistake of that during the New 52?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, why I think that's one reason why I kind of gravitate more to following the media versions now, because I don't have to worry about it. I can just accept the fact, okay, on Lanterns, I'm not going to spoil anything, but this is the way this universe is set up. It's close enough to the continuities I know, the lore, the basic lore of the Green Lantern Corps, that I can go, okay, this is this, and that is that, and this is Hal, and that's John, and these are the Guardians, and this is the, you know, and I know all that, and I can just, like, run with it. But if I have to, like, stop and get back into DC, like, you're right, it's like, oh, suddenly all these things happened. It's just like Marvel's continuity of never really being rebooted. How can anybody have gone through all the things these characters have gone through at this point? It becomes just like an anchor around it. But when you go to like the Superman movie in 2025, it's like a whole new universe. And it's like there's aspects of it you recognize, and they do some different things, and they pull like really obscure things like the hypno glasses and bring them back. You know, and that nobody ever thought they'd do anything with, because everybody was like, oh, the hypno glasses, you know. I think that's one reason why I gravitate toward, because we don't have to worry about that. We don't have to worry about trying to, like you said, put everything in a box. We've got a new box. You know, this is the new box. It's over here, this media version of it. The comics are still, you know, trying to make everything fit. And I really don't think they should at this point.
I think the problem is we really should only read comics for about 2 years, and then we should stop. All of us are kind of a problem.
Yeah, we're too late.
Yeah, well, but he's not wrong. like any fan who's been in it for more than like 5 to 10 years, and some of us are well on. I mean, Chris was born with a comic book in his hand, as I like to joke. A lot of us are entering our fourth and fifth decades reading these things. We are really the problem at that point, aren't we? We didn't let it go. We didn't give it the space to completely exit. It's like Star Wars TV shows. You do so many, it doesn't give you a chance to get excited about the next one because they're just rolling right into it. Whereas when, you know, even going back to like 1999, 2002, and 2005, you had 3 years between each of those films. There was a time there to build that excitement. When you just keep reading and reading and reading and reading and reading and never really stopping, you're never giving yourself the chance to take a breath and go, okay, maybe I need to step away from this for a little while.
We also get fiercely possessive of things in our fandom, which is frequently the cause of our displeasure. One of the issues with Star Wars is that it is generational, which should be a good thing, except every generation just wants theirs to be the one that matters.
See, I'm going to say we are a bit of an outlier on this, because Michael, you let Superman go.
Yeah.
And I've let Star Wars go. And I know Chris has walked away from comics at some point. I don't know if Ryan, if you have. So
there's kind of a reason why this podcast took a little bit of a vacation for a few years.
But I will argue that we have let these things go.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we come back, we're able to come back at it with a bit more of a fresh eye and say, oh, well, all right, but this isn't mine. But I can still take it or leave it on its own merits.
It's weird. Comics is like one of those things where I have nostalgia for the feeling I got reading comics when I was first discovering it. But I don't like the comics I read. And partly, like, I got into the comics, like, in the early 90s. That was really my era of getting into it. And it's not just, like, 90s comics suck. Well, a lot of people who grew up with those comics still go back to those and still love those. And I don't. My favorite comics are 70s Marvel or 80s DC or these things like before I had time. Like, I think the era, like, I never want to read the X-Men comics that I got into at the beginning. Like, again, like, I just, and like, even those art styles, I don't like really looking at Jim Lee's art anymore. And that was like, I would have fallen him off a cliff when I was like a teenager reading those things.
It's interesting. I think you're right. And but I think stepping away, I think that's why I don't, and I mean, some listeners probably like, oh yeah, like you hate Damian Wayne. So, you know, it's like, yeah, I know. But I think that's why I don't like, you know, clinch every time I read a version that's like, I can read a new version. I can accept the fact that they've changed. I might not like it, but I'm not going to like, just like take my toys and go home. I can say, okay, I can choose to read this or not read it. Or I can, you know, I'm not as foaming at the mouth, which I feel like a hypocrite, because right now, currently what they're doing on Star Trek Strange New Worlds, the episodes are making me want to foam at the mouth sometimes. But I don't want to get into that. But that comes from a place of loving the first two seasons and then being like, What? Just the last two.
I can totally relate because you and I are always on pretty much exactly the same page when it comes to Star Trek.
Yeah, that's more of a like a choice, like the choices they're making with the, what they're doing right now versus what they were doing to begin with. So
in
it's
the
kind
first
of,
2 years.
It's a little different, but I don't know.
It's weird as well. Andor is what made me walk away from Star Wars.
Oh, really?
Because, yeah, well, Michael and I have this running gag that we're on the island and everyone else is driving past or going past on the boat. And we're just, bye, guys, you have fun. We're going to sit here with our beer and whatever it is we want. But Andor really did leave me on the island, not for the reason everybody thinks. It is an absolutely brilliant science fiction television show. It is a magnificent reboot of Blake 7. I know I'm speaking to the wrong crowd there and I need shag. It's not Star Wars.
And that hits on something that I think is one of the big things that anybody who is becomes like a super fan of something that has a generational aspect to it. So like, you know, with Star Trek, you have like 15 different series to choose from, Doctor Who, comics, Star Wars, etc., is that you can hold two thoughts in your head at the exact same time. One is you have your preferred version of that thing, but that other versions exist, and that does not make it bad automatically. And I think once you wrap your head around that concept, it's not like you're going to watch something that is outside of your wheelhouse and you're going to be like, oh, this is so good. But you can at least watch it and go, oh, I kind of see where this is coming from. But the critical thing there is what Andy said. You have to know everything has a shelf life. Everything has an expiration date. I am a firm believer Flash as a TV series, the Grant Gustin series, went on way too long. And you can see that by the fact that the fans of the show hated it more and more as it went on. And that's because you can only get that lightning in a bottle for a certain period of time, and then you have to walk it away. This is why I think, to a large extent, maybe the UK model of TV is maybe preferable at that point. Because then you have a series of something, and then you have a second series only if there's interest for it, but you don't have something unless it's like an... How long did Are You Being Served go on for?
Oh, don't even start on Are You Being Served. The fact that that's a cultural touch point and the rest of the world pisses me off royally.
But my point is that that's kind of an outlier of British television, right? You usually have things that exist at a very small period of time, and then they move on to the next thing. Mm. Whereas... we don't do that here. we want to run things into the ground.
So like Only Fools and Horses is the other example of a show that ran for like 15, 20 years, but they stopped making series and they do a Christmas special and then they'd have a year off and do nothing. And then they do a Christmas special again. And the family dynamic had changed. The kids had grown up. So there was more to explore. And then they'd do like a 3-part mini series of 3 1-hour episodes and then take another 2 years off. And that kind of model doesn't exist in the American television firmament. But over here, it meant that that show could run for 15, 20 years with the same actors and the same writer. But every time they came back to it, it was a different paradigm because everybody's aged and changed. And they only ended it at the point where a couple of the actors had died and the other actors were like, well, it's just not the same anymore. So they brought it to a conclusion.
The kind of what Michael, to bring something more into your wheelhouse of Superman, like I just finished watching season three, I guess, of My Adventures with Superman. I like that show and I enjoy it to a point, but it's like I realize it's not really made for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's made for a younger audience. It's made for an audience that's more into anime than I am. There's things about it, like, you know, that I was joking with Cindy. I was like, she's like, so how did it end? I'm like, well, you know, the whole thing, like, you know, I can punch you as many times and it doesn't hurt you until I have a lot of heart. And then all of a sudden it hurts you. You know, that's kind of how it ended. You know, it's just basically like, that's the, like, you know, that's just kind of the way that works. And it's like, my brain doesn't like function with stories like that as well, but I enjoy it for what it is. And I understand it's not made for me. It's, I'm the old guy watching this. And I like aspects. I mean, I like it. I like it. I enjoy it. Or I wouldn't watch it. But there's aspects of it I like more than others. There's parts of me that's like, oh, for God's sake, Clark, quit trying to talk everybody out of something. Just punch the bastard. You know, it's like every once in a while you got to hit somebody. You're Superman, you know? It's like,
yeah,
you know,
once in a while you've got to stop crying on the bridge and actually make a decision.
Exactly. Exactly. That same kind of thing. Yeah. It's that same kind of attitude that's kind of like, but it's like, I enjoy it and I watch it, but I realize that's not for me. I'm not the main audience for this. There's aspects of it that I'm kind of lost on. Why are they spending so much time on this? But it's like, oh, this is what the kids are into nowadays, you know, basically. So it's
kids with their Dan Fogelberg records and their MTV video games.
That's right.
Oh, you know who said that quote, Andy?
Nope.
Dominic Santini.
Oh, good man. And I love that you brought it full circle for us to wrap up. Brilliant.
I mean, the chain guns in the EDF pod, Dom.
Wrap up. We're only like 10% done with this episode, dude.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I was doing a Views from a Long Box from 2010.
Chris, anything else to say about the actual story?
No, I don't think so. I think we covered it pretty well. It's out there. If you've got DC Universe Infinite, you can read it. If you've got the greatest Joker stories ever told, the original 89 version, you can read it. If the book Andy was talking about, the Joker, what is it, 80 or is it 75 or 80?
80 years of the Clown Prince of Crime.
Okay, it's in that. Yeah, so it's out there. You can read it. It's a lot of fun. It's apparently a... It's quite a famous issue. It keeps getting reprinted. So it's a prime example of this era of Batman, apparently.
I wonder if it keeps getting reprinted because they have the film for it and they can just reprint it whenever they want to.
Yeah, listeners, write into the comments section. Tell us what your favorite Clayface transformation is.
Hey, tell us when you stopped reading comics.
Andy, Michael, thank you very much for being on our guest again on another episode of Batman Nightcast. Like, you've got a whole new place, the whole Bailey Planet now.
Bailey Planet.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I lost the fortress because the bastards wanted too much money. So I started Bailey Planet earlier.
The key was too heavy?
Yeah. No, I just didn't have $1,500 to drop on renewing it for only 2 more years. So... And I loved, by the way, when it started going away and I didn't pay, they kept coming. It's like, are you sure you don't want to come back? We can lower that a little bit. I'm like, no. You're not going to do that to me. So I started up the Bailey Planet, which I'm still trying to figure out the identity of the site itself. But there's a lot of stuff there to look. And it does serve as the home base for the podcasts that I do. It All Comes Back to Superman is coming to an end. Chris, you're part of the lead up to the end. And the end of October, it'll just transition over to being the Bailey Planet podcast, which I describe as a podcast about Superman and other things, but mostly Superman, which kind of, I think, is my entire personality, just in a statement. But you can also find the Overlooked Dark Knight, which I co-host with Andy, and which leads into Andy, where you can find him.
I'm not on Twitter because I refuse to be in a cesspool. I am on Blue Sky. I am on Facebook. I am on Threads, but primarily, other than the Overlooked Dark Knight, which I do whenever me and Michael can coordinate our schedules and our quite vehemently violent staff meetings.
Oh, God.
that drops whenever we can get together. But Hey Kids Comics is the last Wednesday of every month.
I'll send you the audio of this episode, and you can just cut me and Chris out, and you can drop this as an episode of yours.
No, we've managed to get together at least once a month and put out at least one episode a month, which was good. You know, I mean, we've crossed the 100 episode threshold at this point.
All right, guys, thanks again to Michael and Andy. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back with your listener feedback.
Hey, Kids Comics.
It was the dawn of a new age of comic book podcasting. Hey Kids Comics was a dream given form, a place where two generations of comic book fans could work out their differences peaceably. It was a humorous place where nothing was sacrosanct, and it was our last, best hope for joy. But all things end. But from endings can come new beginnings. This is the return of a comic book podcast. The year is 2023. The name of the show is Hey Kids Comics. Michael and Andrew are back with an all-new look at old comics and all old looks at new comics. You can go home again. Hey Kids Comics, monthly from Two True Freaks and wherever you get your comics-related podcasts.
Hey Kids Comics!
Okay, we're back, and now it's time to get into the, this is the Metropolis mailbag. This is the, Letters to the Batcave, I guess. So,
sure.
Back on episode 51, we reviewed the prose story To See the Batman for Batman Chronicles number 10 with our special guest, Sean Ross, who obviously didn't say enough on the show because he left a comment with another secret question. Since this is a prose version of a comic book, what is one novel you would recommend to comic book fans?
The Pulitzer Prize winning novel, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon. It's an amazing story. It's two characters who kind of sit in for Simon, Kirby, Siegel and Schuster, that type of thing. Like they come together in late 30s New York and start creating this comic book. And you get the whole, like there's a whole prologue where one of them is growing up in Poland as it's being invaded and the way he's able to escape, and he becomes kind of fascinated by Houdini. So they create this golden age comic book character called the Escapist. And he has this whole shtick of being able to, that's his gimmick, where he can get out of any death trap. But it's a fascinating novel. It reads like elements of Mad Men that you would see from that show, with, you know, elements from like that, the Sean Howe book, Marvel, the Untold Story or Untold Legend of Marvel, whatever that one was. It won the Pulitzer Prize. It's a good, good novel, but it's really all about these, you know, teenagers essentially creating a comic book in the late 30s, just the way Bill Finger and Bob Kane created Batman, the way Siegel and Schuster were creating Superman at this time, and the way the publishers and the magazines are trying to screw them over. It ends up bringing, like, we jump through the decades and you see the way Congress targets these guys, or HUAC in particular. It's an amazing book. And if you love like the medium of comic books as a fictional account of what it might have been like for kids essentially to create these things, these funny books that became the medium of comics that we know in the 30s, it's a really, really good book.
Oh, that's a great answer. I'm going to pick one that just popped in my head that I really enjoyed reading, that it's not got anything to do with comics, but I just think it would, it's very exciting. It moves very quickly. That is, I want to get the title right because it's kind of a generic title in its own way. Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer by James L. Swanson, which is, you know, it's basically like a CSI investigation of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and the manhunt for John Wilkes Booth. And unfortunately, I will admit, I do not read a lot of prose. I read a lot of history on comics and media and things. I don't read a lot of prose. And when I'm not reading a comic book, I tend to read reference history books and things like that more than a prose novel. But I read this several years back and I was riveted the entire time, and it would make one hell of a graphic novel. Everybody kind of knows the story to a point, that he, you know, shot him at the Ford Theater, jumped off the stage and all that, jumped to the stage from the balcony. But it's like, there's so much more to it. It's a really fascinating read. You'll find yourself just, enraptured with it and won't be able to put it down. So it's exciting. I mean, it's history. It's like, it's the most exciting history lesson you'll probably ever have. So I recommend that one.
Brett Young of the Fantastic Poor podcast here on the Fire and Water Network said, "I remember getting this issue. Boo, too many words and not enough pictures. I'm glad you guys covered it because I know I didn't give it the time it deserved. I agree it was a quest. In the end, Josh realized it wasn't about validation or photos. It was about boobs."
It all comes back to boobs. Gothos Mansion wrote in to say, "My favorite Batman story that deals more with a fairly realistic character in Batman's world, and Batman only has a supporting role. Probably Die Small, Die Big in Detective Comics number 385, March 1969. It was a very early eBay purchase due to the Batgirl cover. Batgirl. However, I don't think I've ever found a comics character that I identified with more than the protagonist of this tale. He is someone that nobody notices, but he is a huge Batman fan. He gets his dream fulfilled when he helps Batman solve a case before his tragic end. Like many of Robert Kaniger's stories, it is blatantly melodramatic and emotionally manipulative. I really shouldn't like it. It was reprinted in Batman 257, a 100-page giant, where several of the reprints outshine the main story." Yeah, I actually have this issue, and I, at the end, there's this like close-up panel of Batman saying he died big, and he's got these tears coming out from underneath his cowl. I still remember that story. So yeah, that's very memorable.
I just reread it after this comment because I wasn't familiar with it, but yeah, good story. T. Tim Price from the Outcasters podcast on the Right On Network said, "My favorite story from Chronicles featured Jim Gordon and Huntress, the Bertinelli version, where we get the insight that both Jim and Batman see some of Barbara in Helena, which leads to some interesting thoughts on why Bats is harder on her than other heroes. That's the best part, but having Jim and Huntress try to stop criminals on a moving train was also extremely cool." I love that story too, Tim. I just the great cover too. I can see that in my mind. That was a good issue.
I remember that one.
Yeah. Tim goes on, "As for slice of life stories, I immediately thought of a Spider-Man issue written by Paul Jenkins. It featured a young boy stuck in a bad home situation, and his only friend is Spider-Man, as well as secret superhero partner. At the end, the boy is about to move away with the new family and has to say goodbye to Spidey, who unmasks and is revealed to be a black man. So the Spidey who befriended the boy was imaginary all along." Such a powerful moment.
Never read that one. That does sound like a good one. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think he was writing the book around the same time that J. Michael Straczynski was writing Amazing Spider-Man, and Straczynski's was much more of the flagship title at that time because it started off really good and then not so much. Right. So Paul Jenkins' run was kind of silent. It often got forgotten, but there was some good stuff in there.
Okay. I'll have to check it out sometime. Rob McCarthy wrote in to say, Batman prose stories and Batman stories with the Phantom Stranger have something in common. I don't think there's ever been a bad one. Yeah. Probably, usually when the Phantom Stranger shows up, it's a good story.
Mm-hmm. "Apparently, I am now caught in some nightmare loop with Bucky 749. Last time, I said I wasn't going to answer his secret question about Astro City, since that's not what this podcast is. However, since I said the words Astro City out loud in reference to his comment, by someone's logic, that counts as me perpetuating the topic because he asked another Astro City secret question. I'm not going to answer the question or even read it out loud. Instead, I'll mention that Bucky plans to start his own Astro City podcast in the future. Whenever he does, we will plug it on the show."
There you go. Martin Gray from the blog Too Dangerous for a Girl said, "I've seen this cover previously. Wow. But never knew that was what was inside the book. I honestly don't know what it is with me. I read a fair amount of novels, but put great wedges of text in a funny book and I just can't be bothered. Conversely, stick a silent story in the pages and I really can't be bothered. I want pictures and word balloons. The Bill Sienkiewicz art is great, but there should have been at least a half-page spot illo on every spread. Glancing at the text, I see what you mean by the Holden Caulfield of it all. Maybe I'll be in the mood to one day give it a go. Right now, I'm far too phony." My favorite story in Detective Comics by a film writer was the Bob Back to the Future Gale three-parter drawn by Dennis Cowan and Dick Giordano from 598 to 600. Stick it in your list. Well, if it sounds worth a look. Anton First's remarkable design for Gotham City in the 89 Batman film was mentioned this episode. Or maybe it was just him. Anyway, did you guys ever read the 1991 Destroyer storyline that gave comics Gotham a similar look? I have thoughts. I remember Destroyer. I remember, when they blew up all the other buildings in Gotham to the Anton First buildings were just hiding behind him, which I thought was a little, I was like, oh, come on. But I was like 14 or something, but I liked it, that they went that, but wasn't 598 to 600, that's Sam Hamm.
That's not Blind Justice. Oh yeah. No, you're right. That's Sam Hamm. That was Blind Justice.
That's Sam Hamm who wrote the Batman 89 movie.
Right.
Not Bob Gale, not to correct you on air, Martin, but I think that's correct. I think that's Sam Hamm, who then in turn wrote the Batman 89 comic that I wasn't really very fond of. But
so. And, and he said Batman the movie came out in 1988, but remember, he's in a different time zone. He's further ahead of us, so might have come out in 88 for him.
Well, the trailer did, so there you go. That's it.
On episode 52, we covered Batman 386, the first appearance of Black Mask, and Batman and Robin Year One, number 7. Gothos Mansion said, "Like most characters who debuted after I started collecting, I consider Black Mask a new villain, even though he's 40 years old. Damn, I remember buying Batman's 40th anniversary digest, and now that isn't even the halfway point of his history. I didn't realize Black Mask had gotten to be a big deal until I got an eBay recommendation for this issue. Why is the price so much, I wondered. A guy I worked with who plays Batman video games told me Black Mask was in whatever video game was released at the time. I guess that drove up the price. I'm glad I got mine for 75 cents back in the day. Of course, then it was just the next issue of Batman, which I got every month.
Yeah, that I had the same sticker shock. Well, more so when I, like I've said this before, but I was at a Comic Con and I saw Batman Adventures number 12 up on the wall with like key silver and golden age comics. And I'm like, why? And I'm like, oh, wait, that's the first comic appearance of Harley Quinn.
Yeah.
And and I never thought about that because I thought about her continuity appearance in the Batman, the No Man's Land special that in that era. But it's like, no, and luckily I do have that issue. So if I ever, you know, if things get bad enough, I'll have to, if I never need to sell it, I can, I guess. So Bucky749 writes in, I'm not a fan of Black Mask. Maybe I haven't read enough stories with him, but if there is a crime boss in Gotham, I'll take the Penguin any day of the week. Well, yeah, I mean, I kind of like the Penguin. I really like the whole Iceberg Lounge thing, which I'm glad they did that in the Batman and then the subsequent Penguin series. I do like that aspect of the Penguin.
Rob McCarthy said, they must have meant Black Mask to be huge. Sadly, he's one of a few Batman bad guys I only know from the fan pages.
He's actually, you know, been around. I mean, well, he did go away for quite a while, but then he came back around and he's been kind of a big deal since then, I guess. Tim Price from The Outcaster says, make no mistake, I love Mark Waid's writing and his ability to have reasonable explanations for sometimes nonsensical actions. But the flip side is the more things are explained, the more it invites follow-up questions. So, okay, Clayface held onto his victim's body for reference, but couldn't he have taken pictures instead? And that's just the physical appearance. But an equally important thing for reference for impersonation is his voice. Since comics are not an audible medium, it's almost always ignored how shape changers and even disguise experts manage that. It's not that easy. And if the answer is he made or found recordings, then again, why not use visual recordings too, i.e. photos? Dick's ongoing school and social worker problems are honestly my favorite part of the series. Not saying it should be the main storyline, just that I'm enjoying it a lot and glad it's included to add very different but significant stakes to the story.
And the social work threat in the story of the Batman and Robin book will kick up another notch in the next episode that we cover it.
Yes, yes. And it's kind of like we were talking with Michael and Andy, the Spider-Man being more about, you cared more about Peter Parker's life than you did who he was fighting that month, even though they introduced all those great villains. Right. So it's a nice balance in this comic. And it's definitely a Marvel influence, obviously. So. Mm.
Andrew Leyland from Hey Kids Comics and the Overlooked Dark Knight said, why didn't I just have him read this comment while he was here?
I don't know.
He said, once again, Chris is my brother from another mother. I bought this off the newsagent's rack as well, and my 14-year-old self was quite amazed by how dark this was. I don't recall being bothered that Batman only showed up on page 21, as I enjoyed the story and Tom Mandrake's art was appealing, even if I was very much in the Don Newton camp. This was a great issue, and Black Mask was a thing for about 5 minutes. Coincidentally, there was also an issue of Peter Parker around this time that was all about J. Jonah Jameson, with Spider-Man being merely a shadowy presence. Maybe there was something in the water.
I remember that one. Yeah, I think I bought that one off the stand too. So, Nate the Great said, I think Mitch's run on Batman might be a little dated. Black Mask just wasn't a great villain. Plus, I think Chris and I might be some of the few people who remember Nocturna and the Night Slayer. Wade's Year One is just a better story, especially its focus on what it was really like for Dick to be Robin.
Paul Kinn from DC Special Cast and The Sandman Slept here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network said, Ryan, I love the idea of Gilda Dent becoming Two-Face. I just hope if they do it, they don't give it away in the trailers. Doug Munch is an underrated writer, in my opinion. This issue is great, and I think he did even better work on Spectre and Moon Knight. Oh, absolutely. Like, I love so much of his stuff in Marvel, especially Doug Munch's work on Master of Kung Fu was amazing.
We know you like that one issue of the Spectre with Madame Xanadu, right?
That's I do. I mean, well, yeah. I professed my love for that on other shows. Paul said, I too bought this issue off the stands and thought it was dark, but I was pushing 20 and was all in on that stuff then. I do think Doug overdid it a little, as you guys talked about, but still a good origin for a good villain. And I had never thought about what you said about Black Mask might have gone into obscurity if Munch hadn't brought him back into Batman. I think you might be right.
Yeah. I mean, if he hadn't come back on the Batman titles, I wonder if somebody else would have dug him up. They may have, but
eventually everybody does. I'm sure he would have been.
Yeah. Rob Kelly from Fade Out, Treasure Cast, and others on the Fire and Water Podcast Network said, I bought this issue off the stands and really thought this was the introduction of a major new villain. Black Mask had the look, name, the backstory, and then not a lot. I know he eventually returned to the comics and even made it into the movies, but during the years I was reading Batman comics, nothing. Tom Mandrake was such a great fit for Batman, like if Gene Colan was inked by Klaus Janson. And I'm not just saying that because we share an alma mater. Where'd you go to school, Rob? Where was that again?
On episode 53, we covered Detective Comics 553 and Batman and Robin, year one, number 8. Gothos Mansion said, Harvey Bullock first appeared in Detective Comics 441, which was written by Archie Goodwin. I never considered the Bullock in that issue to be the same character as the Munch version. Harvey wasn't overweight in Tech 441. I got 441 as a back issue long after I read the Munch run, so I was surprised to see Harvey Bullock in a 70s comic. As far as I remember, Daphne Pennyworth only appeared twice, one in Batman 216 by Frank Robbins and Irv Novik, and then in the famous Batman 227. I am curious if Daphne is going to return. I thought I was the only person who remembered her. Well, we know now that the character that we were talking about in this one, character who's just been introduced in the current Batman series by Matt Fraction and Jorge Jimenez, is a new character named Verity Pennyworth. Anyway, Gothos Mansion also said, by the way, I hope that was insightful. I wasn't trying to sound like a know-it-all. My mind is way too clogged with Bronze Age Bat knowledge, and I forget what I read in the new issues after about 5 minutes. Well, did you hear the discussion that we had about an hour ago?
Yeah, I'm with you there. Yeah, and no, you're not coming across as a know-it-all. Thanks for, we want you to send in information. I mean, that the Fire and Water Network was built on us, people like you and me and Ryan writing in, and, bugging Rob and Shag in the early days. So, yeah, it's not a bother. We enjoy it. We enjoy the feedback. So, Bucky749 said, I've never been a big Black Mask fan. I like King Tut. Well, I like King Tut too, but I guess they did do a storyline. And was it Batman Confidential, Batman Chronicles, was drawn by Garcia Lopez? It was kind of with Riddler and King Tut.
I don't remember that.
Isn't that a thing like later, like maybe right before New 52, something like that? I can't remember. It was back in the mid 2000s. I have to look that up again, but anyway.
Tim Price said, gosh, in 2 short years from Detective 553, Bullock will become a supporting character in Paul Kupperberg's Vigilante run, which was a stealth pilot for Checkmate. So by 1989, Harvey was completely out of the Batman books until the animated series brought him back. I wonder if that meant nobody working on the movie even knew who he was, or if DC would have nixed his inclusion. For Batman and Robin, I love how the series continues to show how wicked smart Dick is, even as a kid. He's not mature, sure, but he thinks as fast as he moves. Wade is really cementing why Dick Robin Nightwing is a top hero in the DCU.
Mm-hmm. Super Captain wrote in to say, I'm a big fan of Black Mask. Like a few other Bat villains, Wrath and later Hush, he's kind of an inverted Bruce Wayne in his origin. And like a bunch of Bat villains, there's an element of the grotesque Joker, Two-Face, Clayface, Killer Croc, and the mask gimmick works perfectly. Disfiguring people, like Cersei, with his mask reminded me of the 5th season episode of the original Twilight Zone series entitled The Masks. Gruesome stuff indeed. Oh yeah, that is a good, yeah, that does remind me of that, yeah. Glad to hear that we will be getting another series of Batman and Robin by Wade and Samney. The only related titles that I am currently reading are World's Finest and Batgirl, so there is room for more Batman on my pull list. Yes, most definitely. When's that come out? Is that like dropping in the next, or has it already hit? I haven't been to the comic shop in about a month, so.
Dynamic Duos, the sequel?
Yeah.
First issue is already out.
Oh, okay. Well, it's waiting for me then. So there you go.
Yeah. We got a comment from Rodney Trainum. I think this is a brand new commenter. If if you've been listening to every episode and commenting before, Robbie, I am very sorry. Your name looks new to me. He said, recently, I read all three issues of the original Black Mask story. This reading made me think about how society at that time romanticized the rich and wealthy. I also thought of a certain political figure who Roman Sionis reminded me of visually and somewhat behaviorally. I probably need to consult the Batcave Companion or another book or two to confirm any truth or doubt, but I couldn't help but think Donald Trump was a model for Sionis' Black Mask. I would rather have Roman Sionis as president, personally. As to Detective 553 itself, I think the work Klaus Janson did as a fill-in artist was commendable, but it was inconsistent with what Tom Mandrake established in the first part. The cover itself, the results of the removal of the masks, looked more gruesome, and the Gordon Bullock scene was really good, but I think other parts of the story weren't on par for me. The cover did creep me out as well, but in its disturbing, horrific imagery in comparison to Batman 386's cover. I need to listen to the episode again to see if you discussed the Green Arrow story, but I noticed a mistake in that story. If you note, the next to last page, Dinah Lance had curly hair as if she had a perm. On the last page, the perm was gone. Did it disappear after a few hours of sleep? Jerome Moore is a fantastic artist, but where was editorial on this error? Maybe I'm just nitpicking here. We did not cover the Green Arrow backup story with that odd picture of Dinah Lance having curly black hair, but I did talk about that years and years ago on my blog, Flowers and Fishnets, the Black Canary blog. So if you want to know my thoughts on that one, you can head back to that site. I assume it's still up on Blogspot somewhere.
Now, I'm just throwing this out there. Is it possible that that panel was miscolored and it was supposed to be Onyx, who was African-American and not Dinah, and they colored her skin incorrectly?
No, it's the scene is different. Like, she's back at home. Like, she's taken her wig off. Like, it's clearly the scene. It's supposed to be Dinah. It's just, it's okay, a weird little moment. But
I just always think of that run with Jerome K. Moore and Onyx, because she was a cool looking character.
Yeah, Onyx was, yeah.
I really love Jerome K. Moore's art anyway. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Why in the hell he wasn't bumped up to draw Batman, I do not know. I've never understood that. So,
yeah.
But anyway. And on the last episode, we covered Batman number 386 and Batman and Robin year one number 9. Rob McCarthy said, "You didn't really think Mark Waid of all people would punk out Two-Face. Waid's got some tics I don't like, but the good thing is nobody's a joke to him. You give him Trapster, he's going to show why glue is scary." Actually, the discussion about the Trapster will come up in the first episode of The House of Frankenstein this season, which Cindy and I have already recorded.
Nice.
Cindy's has some fun with the Trapster. This is her first encounter with the Trapster, and she definitely has some fun with that character. Yeah.
Trapster or Paste Pot Pete?
And I told her that, and she's like, "What?" Yeah. So.
Bucky749 mentioned that Clayface in the Bat manga by Jiro Kuwata used his powers differently than how he does in year one. In the manga, Clayface turns into kaiju-sized animals to commit crimes. Also, there is a time limit on his powers, and he has to return to the cave to submerge himself in the mud to recharge. Well, it sounds like the Bat manga would fit right in line with the comic we covered today, because the Clayface could do that.
Yes, and I have read the Bat manga, and I really enjoy those comics. They're beautifully drawn, and they're a lot of fun. Yeah. Yeah. Tim Price wrote in to say, "I didn't really think too much about Grimaldi's fate in the series. There's been other instances of characters created in retroactive series like this one being a setup for said characters to return to modern story shortly afterwards. But yeah, being summarily dispatched was a fine tactic as well. I liked Waid using the two big failings of arrogance that happened to a lot of supervillains, underestimating Grimaldi, thinking he had Clayface under his thumb, and short-sightedness, the faces killing Grimaldi instead of continuing to use him. It bites them all in the backside." Speaking of which, I mean, Two-Face and Clayface, you know, they could be a band called The Faces. Wasn't Rod Stewart in that? I think so.
He was. And Ronnie Wood from...
Ronnie Wood, that's right.
Gothos Mansion said, "I should have had more faith in Mark Waid. I totally thought, and was very unhappy, that he appeared to be making Two-Face look like a mook to make his new character look cool. That has happened way too often with writers who I don't feel match Wade's skill. Remember how Jerry Conway always took a piss on Doc Ock to make Hammerhead appear more formidable? I'm glad Waid fooled me this time."
Yeah, that, I mean, comic writers have been known to do that. Take their darling and, oh, they're mm-hmm. so cool because they just took this character out, you know, so yeah. But yeah, luckily, Mark Waid didn't do that. James Williams said, since the character is named Black Mask and usually dresses like a gangster, I've always assumed that he is a tribute to the famous pulp magazine Black Mask. Black Mask is considered to be essential in making hard-boiled crime drama popular. It published Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, Earl Stanley Gardner, and many more. Classics like The Maltese Falcon were first published as a serial in Black Mask. Having a character named after the magazine who dresses like a character from a hard-boiled crime story just seems like the perfect tribute. I did not know that, and that does make sense. That might have something to do with the picking of the name.
Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't know that either, but that sounds awesome. That'd be,
yeah, thanks for dropping that knowledge.
Makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. All right, folks, that's it for this episode, but we will be back next month with issue 10 of Batman and Robin Year 1, plus another classic Batman story.
Chances are it's not a Silver Age story, though. Batman Nightcast is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for this show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also find Batman Nightcast and the Fire and Water Network on Facebook, Blue Sky, and other social media platforms.
If you enjoyed this episode, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast to support Batman Nightcast or your other favorite shows on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
As always, thank you for listening. You know the cloud gets bigger as a word goes.